Today is August 17, 1993. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Frank Nigro, a pioneer Alaskan now residing in Seattle. This tape is made possible by a grant from Pioneers of Alaska Foundation. We are recording in the home of his daughter, Marilyn Nigro, in downtown Fairbanks, Alaska. You, like many other pioneer Alaskans, had some unique experiences during those early days, in your case, beginning in 1936. Let's start with your trip getting here. What were some of the highlights of that journey, and what were your reasons for coming to Alaska at that time?
Well, we had a depression in the 30s, and I was working in an office in New York City, Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, and the stock market crashed in 1929, and so the people I worked for kept me working until 1932, when things got so bad that they couldn't afford to pay me $12 a week. So there for a while, I was looking for work, but it was almost an impossibility because there were too many people out of work. And anyway, the way it ended up was that another fellow and I, we decided we'd go to the West Coast. We'll hitchhike to the West Coast and see, perhaps we might be able to get work in between or when we get to the West Coast, California. Mm-hmm. Well, it so happened that we kept going on the road there for a while and then decided that it was too hard on our feet because we were walking too many miles and getting blisters.
Shoes were wearing thin.
So one day, somewhere in Pennsylvania, we saw a slow-moving freight going our way. So I looked at Pat. His name was Pat O'Hagan, my friend. And I said to Pat, I said, "Pat, that's going our way. Let's hop it."
So, oh, the famous hopping trains in the Depression.
And it was an open gondola car. Those cars used to carry steel and stuff like that. Well, anyway, we jumped the train, and it was so nice to be traveling instead of walking, and so we decided we'd stay with the freight cars going west. Well, my mother had told me that there was a friend of hers living in Omaha, Nebraska, and if we looked her up, maybe she could guide us a little bit towards where there were some jobs, maybe, you know. Well, we went to see that lady, and she had become a widow in the meantime. And so she had a son who had gone to San Jose, California, and he was working there. So she mentioned that if we looked him up, perhaps he could line us up with some work. Well, we did to San Jose, California, and when we got there, he was living with a friend of his. They had a small apartment. His friend was working in a cannery, and the fellow that I mentioned, her son, was a truck driver. They were both earning 17.5 cents an hour working, and as far as jobs were concerned, they didn't know where they could tell us where to go, you know. So we decided we'd go straight down to Los Angeles, which we did, always hopping freight, you know. Mm-hmm. And we got there, I remember we jumped off that train and cleaned up, went to a small restaurant close by to where we were, jumped off the train. It was a lot of mom and pop businesses in those days. Mm-hmm. And we had hotcakes there with coffee and butter and syrup for 10 cents. But...
Did you have 10 cents?
Yeah, we had money.
Oh, you had a little
bit. Yeah, when we left New York, we took money with us. We didn't do any bumming as far as food was concerned. Mm. The only thing we bummed were the rides to get us to the points we wanted to go. Well, things were very reasonable in those days. From time to time, we would jump off the trains wherever the trains would have to, the locomotives would have to take water and coal. They didn't have no diesel trains in those days. They were just steam engines.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to replenish their supplies of coal and water. And wherever they stopped, why, we would run to one of those little mom and pop stores, and we'd get a loaf of bread and some cold meats and a container of milk. And we fed a lot of those guys that were on the road in those days.
Mm.
There was lots of them, saying, you know, looking for work, well, like we were.
But no money.
And anyway, we ended up going down through New Mexico and Arizona, and we went into Texas, and from there we went into El Paso, went across the border into Mexico, thought we might see a bullfight, and that was in the month of June.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hot. It was 115 degrees at that time. And I'm not accustomed to that kind of heat, you know. So we didn't see the bullfight because it was too hot. But anyway, things were very reasonable also there in
New Mexico.
Yeah, well, that was, I'm trying to name it, the name of the city there. There's, Juarez.
Mm,
Juarez.
Yeah.
So we got a room for both of us for $1 American. Two big double beds in the room and pitchers of water. They didn't have running water in the room,
mm-hmm.
just pitchers of water.
So you really had a roundabout way of getting to Alaska.
Yeah.
Seeing most of the lower 48
yeah.
before you got here. So.
Well, anyway, what took place there was that we had to get something to eat, so we went to one of those little stores that they had close to the hotel where we stayed. We bought some bread, some cheese, and a bottle of wine for the equivalent of 17 cents, American money. And we went back to the hotel, we had lunch there, and we stayed the night there, but we didn't see the bull fight. And the following day, we decided this is a little too hot for us. So, went across the border. But going back across the border, we had to cross a little bridge, and it cost us, I think it was 2 cents to cross that bridge. Well, then there was immigration there, see, American immigration. So they wanted to know when we had got into Mexico and so forth. And we told them we just got in there yesterday. Well, they said there's an epidemic of some kind there at that time. And in order to get back into the States, we had to take shots at that point,
mm-hmm.
or else they wouldn't let us go across. So... Anyway, the doctor there that gave us the shots, and we had to file a form, and when I filled out the form, he says he had gone to a school, a medical school, with a fellow that, by the name of Nigro, and he wanted to know if there was any relation. I said, no. Well, then anyway, the way it worked out is he let us across after we took the shot. And we went, from there we went to catch a freight, and we ended up in Chicago. In Chicago, Pat, the fellow that I was with, had two uncles living there, both railroad engineers. And they invited us to stay there and clean up a little bit, get a little rest. And one of the brothers one day took us, at that time there was the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. So he took us to the fair, and we went through the fair and enjoyed every bit of it because it was new to us.
So this is in 1933?
Yes.
Yeah, so it took you a while then to get up to Alaska.
Yeah, wait till I tell you. So then they took us through all the slaughterhouses there and the stockyards. And that was a very interesting trip, going through the stockyards. So we went to one slaughterhouse after another, and they showed us how they killed the pigs and how they killed the cattle and so forth. And in those days, everything was done by women. We watched them put bacon in packages, you know, one slice at a time, you know. Well, that created jobs, you see, which was okay. So anyway, we stayed there a couple of weeks, and then we decided we'd better go back home. Couldn't find no work. So we got home, and then President Roosevelt at that time instituted the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Oh, CCC.
Yeah. So after a month or two, we decided, well, there's nothing else. We might as well join the CCCs, which we did. And they sent me to Vermont, state of Vermont. They sent Pat to Montana. So anyway, that was a good experience for me because the camp that I went to, their project was to get up to Mount Mansfield. And they would drive us in trucks every morning to the base of Mount Mansfield. And there, they teamed us up two people at a time. We had these 8-foot, two-man saws. They didn't have the type of saws they have today, you know. Mm-hmm. And so one man on one end, the other man on the other end.
Oh, yeah.
And an axe.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to have to climb that mountain every morning. And they had a forester there who would slash certain trees that he felt had to come down. So our job was to cut those trees down, limb them, and then cut the trees I think it was either 4 or 6 feet lengths, so they could be handled, you know.
All with the two-man saw.
Yeah. See? Mm-hmm. But I was lucky. They came with me with an old-timer. There was a local man, and he knew how to sharpen saws. And by golly, that made the job a lot easier for us, you know. I stayed in the CCCs for 18 months. Then I decided, but I was doing a little reading there, and I came across some material about the state of Alaska. Being not too well populated at that time, and they had all kinds of opportunities for a new person coming into the territory. It was a territory at that time. They had there was a timber industry, a fishing industry, the mining industries, and so I decided, well, I should get a job somewhere.
Certainly in timber.
Yeah, one of those, yeah, that's right. I already had that experience.
Yeah.
So anyway, one day after staying home there for a year or so. And with my folks, my father had a candy store, one of those mom and pop candy stores. And I helped there a little while, but that was too boring for me, and no money. So anyway, I had made an acquaintance with the man that delivered bread to my father. And he was, his family were in the bakery business, but his job was to deliver the bread. We used to buy one or two loaves of bread every day. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he only charged us 4 cents a loaf.
So now this would have been about 1934?
No, that was, those days. Mm-hmm. So in 36, this fellow, he was a motorcycle enthusiast. Mm-hmm. And he was talking to me about going to California and trying to break a cross-country record on his motorcycle. So kiddingly, I said, if you put a sidecar on that motorcycle, I'll go with you if you take me to Seattle, Washington. And sure enough, he took me up on it. He put a sidecar on that motorcycle. And they came when he did. We both left. And it took us 10 days to go from Seattle to Seattle. From New York City, Brooklyn, New York to Seattle. Going cross country because.
And this was in the summertime?
That was in the spring of the year.
Yeah, so.
Sometime in April.
Avoiding storms by that time of the year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, the way it worked out was he took me to Seattle and then he went down south to California. It goes mm-hmm. down around Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And from there, he shipped his sidecar back. Mm-hmm. And he went himself back to New York trying to break the going record, whatever it was. I didn't know.
But you got your ride to Seattle.
Yeah, he left me there in Seattle. Well, in Seattle then, I had to try to make arrangements to go to... I asked to go to Valdez because they said there was a mine there that I figured, you know, that I might be able to get a job at that mine. Mm-hmm. But the way it worked out was the man that I was talking to at the Alaska Steamship Company, he asked me some questions, you know, what was I going to do there in Valdez? And I told him I was going to try to get a job there, and if I couldn't get a job, well, then I would hitch a ride from Valdez to Fairbanks, mm-hmm. and then I would try to get a job here in Fairbanks. Well, he said, you know, he says, the roads are closed. They don't open up until breakup time. And I said, well, when is that? He said, sometime in June. He says, the passes are all filled up with snow. And, well, I didn't know what was going on in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know that they had that much snow where they couldn't, you know, keep them clear. But that's the way it worked. So, while I was talking to the man, there was another fellow about my age. He was sitting there. So he proposed that we try to go to Ketchikan. And his father was in charge of a crew of timber workers, you know. And so, I said, I can work in the cutting down timber. So anyway, I decided to go with him. So Alaska Steam didn't have a boat going in Ketchikan that week. So we went to another company. I think it was called Northland Transportation Company. Mm-hmm. And we booked the steerage passage from Seattle to Ketchikan for $17 each. So anyway, the way it worked out is we left on that appointed day, which was a couple of days later. And so that night, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, the ship was enveloped in a fog. Mm-hmm. And somehow they lost their way. And they hit the rocks. in British Columbia there somewhere.
Mm.
And then, of course, being in the steerage, you know, the boat, when it hit the rocks, you know, it kind of shook the boat, you know, and that woke me up. Of course, when you're riding the steerage, you don't take all your clothes off. You sleep with your pants on and your shirt on. The only thing you take off is your shoes. And it wasn't so hard for us to put the shoes on and get up above and get up there. Well, it was all dark and you couldn't see nothing, you know. And so maybe about 4 or 5 o'clock that morning, it was getting daylight, and I could see big trees all around. And I said to myself, gee, we must have hit an island, which we didn't really, you know. And there we were. You know, the tides, they're moving up and down. It keeps that water moving up and down.
Mm-hmm.
But we were lucky. The water was very, very smooth, just like just as smooth as could be, like glass. That's one good thing about that, hitting those rocks at that time.
It kept you on the rocks, and otherwise you would have been pushed off.
But every time the boat went up and down like that, every time it would hit those rocks down below, and the ship would shudder.
But you didn't take on a lot of water, though.
Well, wait till I tell you. When it hit the rocks, it has two holes in that hull down below, see? And the water was coming in. And so the ship didn't have enough pumps to pump out the amount of water that was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it worked out was, in order to get out of there, they had stopped all the engines to begin with. But there we were stuck. So what took place then was that this ship carried freight and passengers both.
Mm-hmm.
And the freight that they were carrying was going into different tanneries, going up the coast of Alaska. And so they had a winch operated by steam, a steam winch. So in order to get out of that spot, they lowered one lifeboat with three men in it. And they took the heavy rope, you know, that they use on those winches, and they took that and they rowed over to another big, looked like an island, but it wasn't really, just another big chunk of rock, heavy big rock. So they wrapped it around that big rock. And then what happened was they started the steam winches on the ship, and they slowly pulled the ship out of that area.
Mm-hmm.
With the purpose was to do that. See, was to get that ship out of there, you know. And then they started the engines, and then they took the lifeboat back. They lifted it up, put it back on the ship again, and then they slowly started out. And then as we were slowly starting it out, the ship started to take on so much water that it got out of
an angle,
see. So they decided, well, maybe we should abandon the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And the ship was going to try to find a spot where it could get so it wouldn't sink, you know, on the beach. The beach, the ship.
The ship. So, yeah. Were there a lot of people on the ship at that time?
Quite a few passengers, mm-hmm. Yeah. So women, children,
and not really enough lifeboats to
take
care of everybody, which I guess was a real problem in those days. What was the name of the ship, that particular one?
It was either the North Sea or the North Star. I don't remember which one it was. I know the North was connected first.
North something.
North Sea or North Star. I don't remember which it was. But the way it worked out was that they said, well, we have to abandon the ship, and women and children go first in the lifeboats. And after they're in the lifeboats and down into the water, then the men could go down on it, could climb on the lifeboats. So, but no baggage. Everybody was to go with no baggage.
And steerage last a bit.
Yeah, leave baggage on the
Titanic.
Yeah, because there wouldn't have been no room anyway, you know, on the lifeboats.
Yeah,
to fill them up, you know. So anyway, we started, that's what took place. But an incident happened there. I never learned how to swim. So I was always leery of the water, you know, especially out in the ocean, you know. So the way it worked out was that when they said, okay, all the men can now get on these lifeboats, I happened to be the first one on that lifeboat because I figured I wanted to get a place there. Mm-hmm. So you know, the way those lifeboats were lowered into the water, there was one man, one of the sailors on one side, the other sailor on the other side, and each one lowered the boat by ropes, you see.
Mm-hmm.
The man on the left-hand side, he started to lower the rope, and the boat, lifeboat went up like this, see. The other guy didn't do nothing. So, there I was, sitting up there all alone, because they were going to fill up that lifeboat, you know, before they started to put it down into the water. But anyway, I was hollering to the other guy down there, you know, stop, you know. They stopped. So they leveled that boat, and then all the men, they all climbed aboard, and then they lowered us in the lifeboat. But as they were lowering us, I noticed there was a lifeboat ahead of us that was being lowered also. And there, at that point where they were being lowered, the water was being pumped out from one of those holes that they got on the side of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that water was going into that lifeboat. You know, in other words, you can just imagine, you know, water coming out, the boat being lowered, and water going into that. Well, anyway, it all worked out, and then we were out there. And, you know, those lifeboats, they're very big, and the oars that they have takes two men and one oar
mm-hmm.
to maneuver those boats around. So what they did was they told us to follow the ship slowly, which we did. But in the meantime, they had an SOS out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, one of the Coast Guard ships caught up with us. So we rowed towards the Coast Guard ship, and we went alongside of it. And, you know, they had these big nets
mm-hmm.
alongside of these ships, you know, these Coast Guard ships. And so when we got next to it, I got under that net, and I climbed up and got up on top and jumped into the Coast Guard ship.
So it was able to take everybody.
They took everybody.
Loss of life.
No loss of life at all.
Eventually went down.
What took place then was that the Coast Guard ship transferred some of the pumps that they
mm-hmm.
that they could use on the boat, see, mm-hmm. on the ship that we were on. And that relieved some of the amount of water that was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And then what took place was they took us into a cove where there was a cannery there.
Mm-hmm.
And there they told us to get off the Coast Guard ship. And then they decided that they had enough pumps on the other ship where we mm-hmm. came off of, you know,
mm-hmm.
To go back on again. And they would take us on into Ketchikan. And they would make sure that we got into Ketchikan. And so that's the way it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
We finally got into Ketchikan. It was very early in the morning. And we got off the ship, and I remember there was nothing but wooden sidewalks
mm-hmm.
there in Ketchikan, at least down there by the dock anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. Gee, I thought to myself, oh boy, what are we getting into over here, you know?
Not off the streets of New York. Not by a long shot.
Not like the streets of New York, no. Or Seattle either. Well, anyway, we found out that this fellow's father had been transferred to another camp in the woods outside of Ketchikan.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a brother there who did a little fishing. And his brother, we found out where his brother was. He lived in a little cabin at the end of the town there. And so we all got together, and I stayed there with them two brothers for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
But it rained so hard there in Ketchikan. Wow. But every day I would walk in town, walk every day to see if I could get a job, you know. Finally, I pestered one guy who was a fish buyer for Sebastian Stewart Fish Company in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fishing season had started.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did give me a job. And he asked me if I knew anything about fish. The only fish I saw were in the meat market, the fish markets in Brooklyn, you know, where my mother used to buy her fish.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what I was getting into. But anyway, they showed me what to do, see, every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned very fast.
Yeah.
He says, you paid 50 cents an hour. Boy, I thought, that's good money, you know, boy. But then what happened was I had to get closer to where I worked. So about a mile down the road, close to one of the New England fish canneries, which was across the street, there was six cabins up on the side of that big hill. I had to climb, I don't know, it seemed like 1,000 steps. But anyway, I asked the owner if she had a cabin there. He said, sure. And I said, how much? He said, $5 a month. So I thought, well, that's good. I didn't have no electricity to pay, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a stove in there and a bed. I just thought,
all needed.
That's right. I had to buy my own blanket here, a sleeping gear.
More members of the family joining us. Pauline Nigro, Mr. Nigro's wife, and some grandchildren. So we're having quite a family reunion here, listening to Mr. Nigro. Tell about his experiences coming to Alaska. So, continue with your story in Ketchikan.
Well, anyway, that man hired a lot of college students, and I was working side by side with those college boys,
mm-hmm.
and it was very interesting. Sliming fish. Cutting the heads off, cleaning them, and processing them in the cold storage plant that they had there on the fish dock. But eventually, and it was a very heavy catch that year, a fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those boats that came in, fish boats came into the dock. They were too heavily laden. They were out too long. They took too many fish. The amount of ice that they had taken out with them when they first started to go out was not enough to keep those fish.
Salmon. Mm-hmm.
And so these inspectors, from time to time, they would go out there and they could see a boat that was very heavily laden. So they go on the boats, and if they saw that fish had spoiled, they told them to dump all the fish out. They couldn't take it into the fish dock.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bad deal for them. But see, the way it worked out was that when the tide went out, all of them dead fish, they were laying on the side of the beach there, mm-hmm. you know. Mm. So you could imagine, you know, big, some of them were big fish, big salmon. Mm. And so that was a rotten shame, you know, to see all that fish spoiled. But anyway, you know, in those days, it was always supply and demand, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if the supply was too great, and the demand wasn't there, why then the price of fish would go down, see? And so it was every day the prices changed. And so I remember the owner, the fellow that I worked for, he would tell them how much he would pay for those fish. Because when they docked, they'd open up their hatches and he would look down there and he'd say 10 cents, 11 cents, maybe 12 cents. That's for each fish. That didn't go by weight. The only
fish.
The only fish that they put on the scales were the big kings. And they paid them
by the pound.
Yeah, accordingly, because there was more demand for the kings,
mm-hmm.
the heavier fish. And so you see, that's why we couldn't get more than 50 cents an hour. But he had a couple other guys there. One was a Norwegian, another man was a Swede. They were both good carpenters. But they couldn't find work in their line, so they worked on the fish dock. But he paid them 60 cents an hour because he used them because this man, his name was Phillips, this fish buyer, this man had a smoke house, and he smoked fish on his own, not for any company, but on his own.
Mm-hmm.
So he was putting an extension on that is a smokehouse, because he had a lot of demand for that smoked salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I remember, it took approximately anywhere from 15 to 20 days to smoke that salmon.
In the cool smoke.
You know, well, had a little fire down below, you know, and you had the fish over the smokeries. And they smoked very, very slowly. But there's more to smoking fish. The way he worked it was he put that fish in tierces with salt, you know. Mm-hmm. And then after being at that tierce for, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 days, they take that fish out, and then they would run it through running cold water all the time, see.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they put them on these racks, you know, where mm-hmm. they smoked them. But he had a lot of demand for that smoked salmon, and he had orders from England, France, wherever there was. They didn't have access to nice good salmon, you know, like Alaska salmon. But after the season was over, then, of course, I heard about the mining going on in Fairbanks. So that following year, I went to Fairbanks, Alaska in 37. When I got here, I was too early. There was a lot of snow on the ground. Second Avenue there, they had snow piled up. One side of the street to the other, one side of the street maybe 5 or 6 feet high. The other side of the street was the same way, and in between they had enough space so you could go from this side of the street to the other side of the street without going all around the block, around the federal building there, you know,
mm-hmm.
Second Avenue and Cushman Street. So anyway, I had to wait. At that time they said, well, you have to wait until the snow leaves and the waters, the rivers open up before any mining can be done, because it was mostly hydraulic mining.
Mm-hmm.
So there we were, you know.
About a 2-month wait?
Boy, another long wait. And even while we were waiting, we had more snow. You know, I mean, geez, it just wouldn't quit, you know. Yeah. But anyway, the way it worked out was that we finally opened up. I mean, things got, these miners were hiring people. So at that time, the FE company was the biggest employer, you know, around here, because they had many camps. And I walked every morning to the FE company offices.
That was on Illinois Street?
On Illinois Street, yeah. Mm-hmm. And checking in there to see if they were hiring any kind of laborers, you know. And, you know, they had these, they call them point drivers, you know. Mm-hmm. They drove points, you know. And that was a hard job, you know, driving points into that frozen ground. Yeah, to thaw out that the gravel, you know, and the an overburden, you know, that was
that was the job that was up for grabs.
Yeah, boy, I tell you. But anyway, the way it worked out was, in the meantime, that year there was so much snow that we had a flood here in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. This would have been in the winter.
Yeah.
Or
that was in the spring.
Spring of 37.
37, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I not only went to the FE company offices, but I always walked around town looking to see where I could get a job. And I had pestered at that time Bill Hunter. He was the Northern Commercial Company, a man in charge of the utilities. We had a utility office there on Second Avenue.
Yeah. Electricity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, that evening, when the waters were getting higher and higher, there was one warehouse there that had a lot of food and stuff down in the lower level, and so they decided that in order to save all that, mm-hmm. They had to get it all out of there. So I happened to be walking by, and Bill says to me, "Hey," he says,